when I'm crafting those questions, I'm thinking about, you know, what's the narrative arc of this conversation that's going to let listeners understand the topic. That craft of style of question and when to ask which kind is the art of interviewing, as I see it.
Welcome to the Craft Podcast, where we interview experts in various fields to learn about their disciplines and how they strive towards mastery. I'm Dan Tedesco, and I love talking to people who are passionate enough to master something. I've been asking curious questions of these craftspeople my whole life, but I think it's worth sharing with others. As you might have guessed by now, this episode we're talking about the craft of great interviews. Let's get right into it.
Our guest today is Russ Roberts. Russ is an economics educator, author of many significant books, and the occasional rap video. He's a fellow at the Stanford University's Hoover Institution and the creator and host of one of the world's leading economics podcasts, Econ Talk. He's an expert craftsperson when it comes to podcast interviewing, which is why we're speaking today. And I'm especially excited to speak with Russ, as I've been an avid listener of Econ Talk since I first started listening to podcasts about a decade ago. Russ, we're really happy to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
And for those who don't know, how would you describe Econ Talk?
Well, it's interesting. You called it an economics podcast. It started that way. It started back in 2006, which was a very long time ago. We've since done about a little over 750 episodes, which is mind-blowing, each about an hour long. And it started off interviewing economists, people I had either studied with at the University of Chicago or friends of mine in the profession or other folks. And somewhere about 5 years ago, I don't know, I haven't looked, but somewhere in the somewhat recent past, I started widening its range. I mean, I always interview people as an economist, but you know, I interviewed people who were doing work related to economics, historians or psychologists, but in recent years, I've branched out considerably, and I don't. It's still okay to call it Econ Talk because I'm an economist, but its subject isn't particularly economics per se anymore. It's really anything, to be honest. It's anything I'm interested in, which is increasingly philosophy, cultural issues of the United States, the state of our country and the democracy, and the tension that's obvious in public discourse, the role of social media, perhaps, and technology and causing that. It's my new tagline is conversations for the curious. So I'm curious. I hope listeners are too, and I try to learn something each episode from a guest.
Let's go back to the beginning with younger Russ. I would imagine that, you know, the conversations for the curious being your interest, there are roots that go back. So when you were younger, did you interview people? Did you get on stage? Did you have an interest in media? And I know your dad inspired you towards poetry. Did you have any other kinds of interests towards creation at a young age?
It's interesting you ask that. A lot of people asking about how Econ Talk got started, but you're asking a deeper question, which is how I got started as an interviewer. And it's funny that there are quite a few hints that I would be interested in podcasting. I remember being at an economics conference with a buddy of mine, and we were doing some shopping outside the conference time, and I was talking to some salesperson, and I was asking her a bunch of questions, and my buddy called me the question box because I was just like to ask people stuff. When I was in a business school at Washington University in the Olin School of Business, Washington University in St. Louis, I had forgotten about this for a while, but I started a series where I was running something called the Management Center. I invited business leaders to have conversations with students. And one of the format for that was I would interview them, and then we did Q&A, and then we would print a transcript of those interviews. And that was sort of an early example of Econ Talk. Yeah. And I realized I didn't really think about it, but I do like interviewing. I also like talking, which is a handicap in an interviewer. If you go back to the early days of Econ Talk, I talked, I think, a little too much and still talk too much sometimes, but I'm curious. I think that helps.
Yeah. Well, I can see kind of the path forming there when you were at Olin. And you mentioned, you know,
I'm trying to remember what the name of it was. I gave it some, what I thought was a catchy name at the time, you know, some kind of conversations. It was called, I can't remember. I'll dig it up. But yeah, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, please do. Fast forwarding a little bit to maybe 2005, 2006, you said before that you started Econ Talk when you realized you were late to the blogging scene. But I guess set the context, what was the world of podcasting and internet media like in your eyes back then?
Pretty embryonic. You know, for me, it was a question of how much time I was able to devote to it. I didn't know how long it would take to create an episode. I didn't know if I could create a regular episode. There's another part of me that you didn't ask about, or I didn't mention when you're talking about when I was younger, which was I always thought it might be interesting to have a talk show on radio. And one of the things I wondered was whether I could do that in any regular ongoing way and keep the rest of my responsibilities as a faculty member or a teacher going. And when podcasting started, I realized, well, this is where I could have my own radio show, which is what it is. But it wasn't obvious then that's what it was. It was this weird thing. When you tell people you did a podcast, they say, well, what's that? And I'd say, well, it's kind of like a radio show you can listen to whenever you want. It's stored on the internet. And you know, I started it thinking, well, this is interesting. I was surprised at how many people would listen. At the time, I'd been a guest on a program, and I asked the host how many people listen. He said, well, I don't know, but about 3,000 people download. And I thought, well, that's a big number. 3,000 people seems like a big number. Of course, it's not by modern podcasting standards, but it still seemed cool that you know, you could go into a room, the equivalent of a virtual room, and there'd be 3,000 people in the audience wanting to hear what you had to say or hear what you had to say in concert with the guest. So I thought this is, you know, exciting and worth doing. And pretty early on, I realized that if I wanted to build up a regular audience, it had to be every week.
Right.
That people would have an expectation of when it would come out. So that relentless schedule was the hardest part. And, you know, I wasn't sure I would be able to do it. And yet here we are 750 episodes later. I seem to have managed it. But that was the question. And in those days, you know, people listened to – there were no smartphones.
Right.
At least in my memory, there weren't any smartphones. I can't remember when the iPhone came out. But – people listen to podcasts in two ways. They either had an iPod, which was a MP3 player that Apple had created. Now it seems like I'm talking about
ancient technology.
You know, the first dishwasher or something. You know, something back in the 19th century or the grain combine. But you'd listen on an iPod or an MP3 player. An iPod was the dominant player at the time, or you'd burn a CD. You'd burn a compact disc with the audio on it and play it in a CD player. And nobody listened in their cars unless they had a CD player and they burned a CD to listen in their car, which people did. But most people would listen walking with their iPod. Not that many people had. I mean, a lot of people had iPods, but nothing like smartphone penetration. So the early days, you know, it was this weird sort of funky thing that some people were able to access or knew how to access. I remember giving my dad and mom an MP3 player preloaded, a cheap one that I bought, and preloaded it with a bunch of episodes because they couldn't figure out how to play it on the web. And I sent them the MP3 player. And, you know, the first question, I bought a few of them. They were inexpensive. I bought one to have just in case he couldn't figure out how to use it, my dad. And sure enough, he called and he said, well, you know, where's I want to say, he said, where's the manual? Actually, I think I'd include the manual. And he said, well, I can't figure out how to turn it on.
Right.
And I gave it to my kid who was like, I think 7 at the time or 9 or something young. And he turned it on in, you know, in 15 seconds. He just kind of fiddled around with it. But for my dad, it was like, I don't see a button that says on off. So I don't know what to do. You know, he was probably 75 at the time, 70 something. And, you know, that whole world of players and technology has changed so much.
Yeah.
And so most of my listeners commute or commuters.
Right.
And right now, of course, there's less commuting because of the pandemic. But most of my listeners historically are commuters who listen in their car through their smartphone or listen while they're jogging or exercising, working at the gym to their smartphone. And that's just a total transformation of what was available in 2006. And I was lucky enough to get started early on.
Yeah. And so what was that that startup process like? You mentioned having to balance this decision of the time investment versus, you know, it's kind of this new unproven technology. How did you make that decision?
Well, you know, I could have been wasting my time, but no idea. And of course, it's still, at the time, there was no way of knowing other than the occasional email I'd get whether many people were listening. The other part of it was we did all our interviews via the phone. So I had to have a technology right. for recording phone conversations. If you go back and listen to the early episodes from 2006 and 7, the audio quality is not very good. Besides the interviewer not being very good, the audio quality is not so good because they're done over the phone. And if you go back and listen to the ones that are from the United Kingdom or, you know, England, typically they're really mediocre because the phone system the connection wasn't as good to calling England. And, right. But you know, for me, I don't know why I kept at it. So part of what I'm telling you is I didn't get that much encouragement from, like, you know, it wasn't like I was having this big success or anything.
Right.
You know, I think it was moderately successful early on. I wasn't sure, but I enjoyed it. And I thought it was a good experience to try to keep it up. And of course, 2008 came along, which was the financial crisis, and the interest in economics went through the roof. And so my listenership and audience grew dramatically between 2008 and 2010. And then I think it probably plateaued. And then it started growing again, probably 5 or so years later, as people became more and more able to access podcasts. But, you know, for me, the other part of it was, I just like talking to smart people every week.
Yeah.
You know, when I look back on it, along with graduate school, it's the single most, not along with it, it's probably more important than graduate school in my intellectual development. My exposure to the ideas and my prep for those episodes, reading the books and essays and articles by the authors to prepare for the interviews just had enormous impact on my intellectual journey and kept me from getting stagnant or stale intellectually. So, you know, it would be worth doing even if nobody was listening.
Yeah.
In a way, the listenership is just great. And the emails I get from listeners, you know, are incredibly gratifying. But it's been gratifying just for me through the process itself.
You describe kind of a beautiful flow and evolution of Econ Talk, which I've been lucky enough to be with you experiencing some of these different eras and epochs of Econ Talk over time. I guess one last question on the startup. Did you ever think about quitting or putting it down for a while? Because, you know, weekly is quite an intense schedule.
Well, I like the discipline. Mm. You know, even though it's hard to do it every week, and it took me a while to realize that I probably don't want to interview an author every week. I want to mix in some people who haven't written books because I like to read the book. So,
right.
You know, reading 50 books a year is challenging. If you go back and look, I probably, besides the other books I want to read, you know,
right.
But if you go back and look, I probably, let's say I interviewed 20 authors a year, 30 maybe, some in a year where there's a lot of them. So that's still a lot of reading.
Yes.
To go with the other reading I want to do. And of course, one of the things that changed over time is that I tried to find ways to interview the people whose books I wanted to read rather than the other way around, right? That was sort of the goal, was let's pick books that I want to read so I can get them in. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to read them if I'm still doing Econ Talk. But, you know, I like discipline. I don't think I ever thought about quitting, actually. You know, the program is supported by the Library of Economics and Liberty, which is a website out of a foundation in Indianapolis called Liberty Fund.
Yeah.
And Liberty Fund's the sponsor. Library of Economics and Liberty is the larger website that Econ Talk's a part of. So, you know, they were always eager to be helpful to me. They paid me to produce it. So it wasn't like I was, it wasn't just a labor of love, although it is a labor of love, but we were making progress. We were all, our audience was grew steadily. And as I said, some years it grew dramatically. It was just, it was fun. It was fun to do. I never thought, this is just too time consuming. It is time consuming. And of course you can spend as much time as you want marketing it, do more preparation. The challenge is figuring out ways to prepare for every week that are still allow you to do something else besides podcasts.
Let's talk about interviewing. Are there any interviewers who inspired you or you aspire towards? And what did you learn from them?
I'm not sure. You know, there are a handful of famous interviewers in the modern era, people like Terry Gross, Fresh Air on NPR. You know, if anything, interviewing is an art. There's a preparation to it, but the real art of it is knowing how much to talk and when to interrupt and when to steer the conversation in a particular direction. And, you know, I always tell my guests, it's a conversation.
Yeah.
It's not me. It's not a Q&A. It's not, a lot of interviews are just Q&A. You know, the interviewer has 8 questions and just goes down the list and answers,
right.
The guest answers them. In fact, usually the host doesn't write the questions. There's a staff that does that. I do all my own prep and decide what to ask. And when I'm crafting those questions, I'm thinking about, you know, what's the narrative arc of this conversation that's going to let listeners understand the topic?
Right.
And I'm an unusual interviewer that way in that a lot of econ talking to the ideas of the guest so that listeners can understand them and ideally connect them to other things. Because that's what I'm doing. The brain is always looking for connections. You can argue that thinking is really the relating of different things, seeing their patterns, similarities, extensions, differences, and so on.
Right.
So, in a way, one of my job, I have different aspects of the job. One is to ask stupid questions that, you know, I can't figure something out. Stupid's not the right word. Ignorant, better word. You know, I can't figure something out that the guest has said, so I ask. Sometimes I want to challenge the guest.
Yeah.
To justify something that they've claimed. And sometimes the guest has inspired me to think of something that wasn't in the original book. It comes from a different episode of Econ Talk or something I've read. And those three things work together to make Econ Talk what it is. That's my interviewing style. So there's clarifying questions, challenging questions, and then what you might call flights of fancy or extensions. And the best conversations are where I say something the guest hasn't thought of.
Yep.
And that sparks something in them to respond. Or I challenge a guest and they come back with their response and I might re-challenge or just leave them alone. A lot of times my listeners complain that I, quote, let guests get away with stuff. And I explain that, you know, if I challenged everything I disagreed with in my guests, I wouldn't have any guests.
Yeah.
Because I'd be challenging them every time. And it's not interesting or pleasant. Or polite. So, you know, I think that craft of style of question and when to ask which kind is the art of interviewing, as I see it, what I'm trying to do. I don't really have a role model. I don't know. It's part of what I'm trying to do is recreate having coffee with my guests. For the listeners to sit in on that conversation. So it's as if recreate's not the right word, create. So right. It's as if, you know, I've scheduled a meeting with an interesting person in a coffee shop and you, the listener, gets to listen in as I probe the ideas from the book or article that we're talking about. And then the author responds. And now, you know, sometimes I said, I talk too much. It's a very delicate balance. The other challenge I have is that in a real conversation, there's a lot of give and take. There's a lot of interruption and banter and asides, and we make various faces and we have verbal signals to show people that we're listening or that we agree or that we're confused or whatever it might be. And doing that over technology, if you're not literally face-to-face, in the coffee shop or in an office or in a studio is hard because the latent signal in Zoom or Skype, whatever you're using, makes it a little challenging. And that's very unnatural for me. So I tend to interrupt too much. And you're doing a great job, I hope, not interrupting me. Maybe you should be interrupting me more, Daniel. But I found it's taken me a long time to realize that with Zoom or Skype, interrupting is just annoying to the listener often. Now, there are times when a guest goes down a rabbit hole or is rambling on about something that's not very, if I'm not interested, after a while, I'm going to interrupt and try to steer it to something I think is more interesting for both audience.
It's really, first of all, powerful to hear kind of how you think about this art of interviewing. And I really appreciate you sharing that, especially since I am, and probably many of the few people who end up listening to this are going to be curious about how to conduct effective interviews. I must confess, there was a period that I stopped listening because I think there was something about the way that you would disagree that turned me off. This was several years ago, since I've come back, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but I can confidently say today that I think you're, you know, exceptionally effective at drawing out differing opinions in a respective way. And you end up interviewing a lot of people who you probably disagree pretty deeply with. So I guess I'm curious about that, that evolution for you as you saw it, your just ability, and maybe the different techniques or heuristics that you use to think about when do you debate a guest and when do you stop and move on?
Well, I have some guests. Robert Frank comes to mind, who, you know, he and I have, I think I've done 7 interviews with him. You know, we don't agree on a lot of things. We both recognize that. We both respect each other. And early on, at some point, I can't remember which episode, I invited him to come talk about some topic. You know, I told him I didn't agree with him, and it would be more of a, it wouldn't be a debate, but it would not be a typical interview. I would be challenging him, and I didn't want to surprise him. I didn't want to sandbag him. And, you know, I wanted to be prepared and to be willing to join the conversation on those terms. I try to do that with most guests. I disagree with a lot. You know, in the early days, I used to feel, as some listeners do, that, well, I can't let them say those things because people might think that person's right. somewhere along the line, I realized it was bad early on. It was early on, maybe 10 years ago, 8 years ago. I realized, you know, it's a more interesting program if the ideas of the guests get an honest hearing rather than a debate. I will challenge points that guests make that I disagree with, but I'm not going to then counter challenge back and forth 5-6 times, even 3 times, even sometimes twice. I will make it clear that I don't agree and say why. It's not interesting to say I don't agree. I'll say why. Right. And I want my audience to hear from the guests their justification. And then I let the audience make their own determination. And I think in the early days, it was more of a, I've got to show them they're wrong approach. And I stopped doing that at some point most of the time, although occasionally I will get a guest that is so, I try not to have guests like this, but occasionally I have a guest who's so different and unwilling to engage with my challenge that I'll challenge back again. Mm-hmm. But in general, my goal is to help the listeners hear the ideas of the guest, hear my perspective, and then make up their own mind.
Right.
I'm not a preacher. My job is to expose listeners and myself to ideas that might make me uncomfortable. Now, having said that, you know, there are a lot of guests that people say I should have that I'm not going to have them on because I don't respect them. You know, I wish I did, but I don't. So I know I can't have a good conversation with them. I've never had a politician on the program.
Yeah.
Because they're not interested generally in having an open intellectual conversation. They have an axe to grind. They have a position on something. And I understand that that's their job, but I don't want to engage that. I don't want to have a conversation around that. That's not fun. Right. And I'm not going to learn anything. I can go read what their claims are anytime, you know, you want. you can. And so I try to make sure I have guests who are eager and able to defend their ideas in civil and open conversation.
So it sounds like, maybe this is common sense, but effective interviewing, it's the art on your side is a balance, but it also does have a lot to do with who you're interviewing. Some people are just not going to be able to engage in the type of discussion that you need to have.
Yeah, and some of them, by the way, aren't good at talking. That's another issue. You can interview an author who's written a wonderful book, but they can't articulate it verbally very well. They answer in short monosyllabic answers, and you're kind of, there's some interviews, I won't say which ones, but there are interviews where I talk a relatively large amount because the guests don't have much to say. Not that they don't have great ideas, they're just not verbally skilled the way they are in writing. And that's just, I've gotten a little bit, more wary of that as I've gotten more experienced and aware that can happen.
Is there any, what is the process that you use to determine people you want to reach out for guests and how you do that? You mentioned books that you want to read and, having them on is great motivation to read the book. Yep. What other kind of core elements do you think about? And is there kind of a pipeline that you build up, a backlog of guests and outreach process?
Well, there's a random or scattershot of it. Interesting people or books or ideas come across my desk or email. People are constantly suggesting guests to me and other. And now because of the history of the program, there are authors who ask to be on the program and publicists who try to get me to interview people about the books that the authors have written.
Those are the ones to be most wary of.
Well, yeah. Well, it helps because at least you know how to get a hold of the author that way usually. Right. Otherwise, sometimes it can be challenging to track folks down or get them to notice that you're emailing them. But so some of it's just serendipity, just stuff that comes along that grabs me. And sometimes it takes more than one suggestion. Someone will suggest somebody, I'll look at their webpage or their book and I'm like, I don't think so. And then a second it suggests and I realize just might be kind of important. Maybe I should pay more. Let me check again. And sometimes I end up interviewing those folks. But also I get interested in topics. So, I'm interested in educational reform. We did 4 or 5 episodes in the last 3, 4 or 5 months on charter schools and whether they work well or not. I had people who were huge advocates of charter schools, people who were huge haters of charter schools, people who were in between, focused on our school systems in New York, one in New Orleans. And so I thought that was really wonderful for helping people think about how to think about charter schools. And similarly, I've done a whole bunch of episodes in the last 5 years on healthcare, as I've tried to understand the U.S. healthcare system, which is Kafkaesque nightmare of tangled incentives and distortions and perversions and some great stuff. But, I'll have a theme like that I'll just always come back to because it's important. Right. I did a lot of episodes on Bitcoin early on, and a lot of people were exposed to Bitcoin who otherwise would not be. And after a while, I did enough. I figured out what I thought I could learn, how it worked, and whether it might be successful or not. And I still have lots of listeners who'd be happy to have Bitcoin be on every episode every week.
But sure.
I'm kind of taking a break. And that doesn't mean there aren't interesting things being done in that space or that there aren't interesting books being written. But for now, I've lost my curiosity about it, or that I think I've reached my level of ability to understand something, deeper than I already do. That would also be true about monetary theory generally and economics. I've done dozens of episodes on monetary theory, inflation, financial crisis. I've learned something from all of them. I have more to learn, but I'm not sure there's a guest out there who can teach me. it's sort of arrogant humility there. So to go back to your question, it's hit or miss. Not hit or miss, it's serendipitous. Some guests I find just through suggestions or just my own surfing of the internet And sometimes I have a theme. And I have a slight backlog. I try to have, you know, 4 or 5 episodes taped already that will be coming out over the next month or so. And sometimes I do 3 in a week just because it sort of works out that way. Their schedule, my guest schedule, my schedule. And sometimes I don't do any for 3 weeks. So it just, it varies.
One interesting thing about the, you know, the fact that you'll have an interest that you go after for a couple episodes in a row. I've noticed the way I listen to podcasts, I have kind of a playlist of all the new podcasts and I just listen to them in order. So I've learned a ton about the history of economics, about the US healthcare system from Econ Talk that I thought were really interesting, but I wouldn't have chosen it on my own, but because I subscribe to Econ Talk, it's in the list that I just go through it, and that it kind of reveals this nugget or area of insights that I wouldn't have otherwise exposed myself to.
A lot of people say to me that, you know, when I have some guest on, they'll say, I didn't think that was going to be interesting, but it was. And I'm thinking, well, that's the whole idea. I mean, if it wasn't going to be interesting, I wouldn't do it. And you've trusted me for hundreds of episodes. Right. Take a chance. It's going to be interesting. Or I'm going to try to make it interesting. If it's not, that could be interesting in and of itself. My desperate attempts to keep interested. Anyway, that's the advantage and disadvantage of this kind of a podcast, because, you know, I'll have a guest on some corner of healthcare and you think, well, I'm not interested in that. Which is fine, by the way. I don't expect listeners to listen to every episode, but many do. And as a result, they get exposed to things they wouldn't otherwise choose. They would, like you say, they'd never say, I'm gonna subscribe to that healthcare podcast.
Right.
And so I try to be a little bit different every week, something a little bit different.
So then if you're doing 3 in a week, I'm curious about kind of the production and the prep. You know, how do you prep yourself if it's 3 in a week? I mean, you read the books. You research the person. What do your notes look like?
Yeah, I don't take very good notes. You know, if I'm doing 3 in a week, I'm not going to be doing three books. It'd be a book and then somebody who does something interesting out in the real world I want to find out about, like the Alex Guarnaschelli, who's the chef at Butter restaurant she started in New York City. I want to hear what it's like to be a chef. So I don't have to prep that. That's, you know, I'm going to read a couple articles and mainly think about what I would ask somebody when I have an hour of their time about what it's like to run a restaurant.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing, is that I'm going to mix up in a three-week. I'm not for a second book usually in that week, unless it's way in advance. I have a chance to read both books
right
simultaneously to get ready. You know, my other prep is just, I've gotten a lot better. I haven't done it for 14 years. You get a lot better at thinking of what questions you want to ask and what the narrative arc is going to be of the conversation. I could probably do it better. I don't spend that much time prepping anymore. I should probably spend some time prepping for my prep. I probably ought to be thinking about what I ought to be thinking about for that episode and that guest. What's the one question I want to make sure I don't forget to ask? I don't do that enough. So I'd like to try to do that. Going forward, I think it's a good idea, don't you think? But anyway, so, you know, the prep varies a lot, but it's generally something I've gone through experience.
Yeah. Well, and I would guess there's a balance. You know, you mentioned before kind of the pitfall of it being too scripted, like Q&A. And if you do too much prep, then kind of there's maybe less of a chance for the serendipitous alleyways. If you have a 3-page list of questions that you want to get through.
And by the way, you asked about taking notes. So when I'm reading a book, I'll clip quotes from the book that I want to use as ideas for questions. Sometimes I'll just take that idea. I'll take that quote and figure out what that question is going to be. So I do take some notes.
Yeah.
The other part that's hard is that I'm increasingly doing these over Zoom with video also. And right. I usually am not looking at my notes anymore. I'm just kind of, I'm not winging it, but I have in the middle of the conversation, I'm thinking about what my next topic is going to be and what the next question is going to be. And I think people who've never done any interviewing don't realize how incredibly multitasking it is, because you might think, oh, it's just, you're just listening and then asking questions, but I'm keeping track of the time.
Right.
Because I want to try to keep it around an hour. It can go longer, but I also don't want it to go shorter. So I'm trying to see how much, where we are, where I think, you know, the questions are going to go. Are we halfway through? Are we a quarter? Sometimes I'll end up saying, well, we're not going to get to that topic that I wanted to, because it's, we're an hour and 10 minutes in, and I really love this moment. And so I'm going to end it here because I think it's very powerful that way. And I'll give up on a question or topic that I was hoping to get to.
Right.
But my point is that since I'm on camera essentially now, I don't look at my notes. Mm. I might pull them up on screen and take a glance. I do. I pull them up on screen and take a glance at them, but I'm not using them as a roadmap the way I did when it was just audio only. And so it is a little more serendipitous now. I kind of let it go where it's going to go. I like that. I think it's great if I can do it well. I don't know if I do it well, but it's you know, it's hard to do. But letting it go in the direction it will go, and being open to an opportunity to expand on something or challenge or talk about a topic that the guest has brought up in the conversation that isn't in the book or that isn't in my notes is really, you know, makes it even better. I think makes it better.
I would agree. I'd also bet that there's no small amount that, you know, the 14 years of experience probably helps make it a little easier, make some of those things that for me right now are extremely conscious and, you know, have my mind all over the place a little more, you know, natural and smooth. As we're talking about the process itself, so... So you have a great interview. Now you have a recorded audio file, and now these days a video file too. What's next? You know, how do you take that and turn that into an Econ Talk podcast? And we don't have to go through the nitty gritty of, you know, what hosting service.
I
guess what level of editing and work do you add to that audio file?
So in the early days, and early is up till a year or two ago, for a long time, I took notes on where I lost my train of thought, or whether I thought there was an audio glitch, or things that I thought might need to be edited out, or where something veered off into something uninteresting and maybe we would want to cut it. I decided a year or so ago that was distracting to the guest and distracted me from the guest wouldn't always see it, but sometimes I was doing these face to face before the pandemic came along, and I thought it was distracting to the guest that I was not looking at them and paying attention. So I stopped taking notes. And what I would do is in that period was at the end of the, once I taped it, I'd go back and re-listen to it. And that was good for two reasons. I could judge myself, which I recommend. It's painful, but it's, you get to hear where you wish you'd done things differently and try to get better. But also I would look for, you know, places where the audio went out or things that were unclear and I need to cut. And I would send those on to my sound engineer. I've since added a producer who does that for me. We're just starting to do, and I'm worried I'll, you know, it's going to hurt me because I'm not going to be listening again, but I'll just listen occasionally anyway, I hope. But so that part is, you know, relatively straightforward. It's still time consuming. It right. was for a long time, but there's some value to it. And by the way, one of the things that's strange about being a podcast host is that you're not really listening so much to the guests because you got all those other things going on. You got the questions that you're going to ask and the time you're worried about and you're trying to decide whether to change topics. And a lot of times you don't really absorb the content. And so it wasn't a bad thing for me to listen a second time because then I could realize, oh yeah, that was a really good point to get someone. I got to remember that. So you know, I have a lot of listeners who listen to every episode more than once, partly because of the modern world, we're so distracted. You know, you listen while you're commuting or walking your dog or working out at the gym and your mind wanders and you realize you missed something. Instead of going back 30 seconds and say, well, I'll listen to it again later. And that way I'll make sure I remember it. So as people do that, You know, audio is different than reading. We go back and reread paragraphs that we find confusing. Audio, it's gone. And then you really want to go back. It seems so weird and time consuming to find where you were. And so you go back to 10 seconds or so the player lets you do, or 15 or 30. And so, you know, people have different ways of dealing with that. But one way they deal with it is just listen a couple times. And some people listen more than twice even, right, especially to episodes they think are deep or important. It's a whole interesting question of whether one of my guests, Venkatesh Rao, raised this question, an interesting question of whether you should spend your time writing books or spend your time recording podcasts or spend your time on Twitter. There are all different ways to communicate ideas.
Right.
Some are more efficient than others. Some are effective than others. Some have a bigger audience than others. I have a much bigger audience for Econ Talk than I do for any book I'm going to write. Does that mean I shouldn't write a book? Nah, probably not, because books are a different intensity. Right. So it's probably a great thing that, you know, a smaller audience will go more deeply into the ideas in a book than they would in a hour-long conversation about it, say.
So I'd like to ask a little bit also about how podcasting has changed you, Russ. And I'm going to read a quote from the Jonah Goldberg podcast and ask you to comment on it. So you said, at some point in Econ Talk, I realized I wanted to be open about my biases. And I discovered that by being open about my biases, I had to confront them a little bit, because here I am saying them out loud. And I realized, well, gee, do I really believe this now? And as a result of the accumulation of those conversations, my views on a number of things have changed quite dramatically. And I found I hear that in the podcast. I think that's a description of a really powerful thing that's happened to you. And I'd just like to get your comment. Maybe could you go a little deeper and share some examples of where that's been the case?
Yeah, so I've been forced, which has been a wonderful intellectual journey, part of my intellectual journey. I've been forced to think about whether, you know, what I believe to be true actually is true. I realized that most of my life I never thought about it much. I suspect I wasn't and am not alone. I think that's a common problem we all have, is that we just assume we're right and we just ignore all the things that might suggest otherwise. But I have guests on who disagree with me, and they were smart, nice people. I had to take it seriously that I could be wrong. And it's not like I've, you know, flipped my worldview or given up my religion or you know, changed ideologically 180 degrees. It's just that I've become more embracing of the strong opinions weakly held mantra. And I've become a little less dogmatic about the things that I believe as being reliable all the time. It's very liberating. I say this all the time. It's really liberating to say, I don't know. In most times in life, giving an answer to a question gets you somewhere. So you tend to be focused on answering them. But being able to say, I don't know, is a different skill. And as I get older, maybe as people get older generally, or maybe I'm lucky, it's just me, I found it easier to say that. And that's great. It's really liberating. And a lot of the benefit of that for me has been subtle. Instead of figuring out different ways to hammer on these ideas that I quote know are true, I've gotten more interested in finding out about other ideas. Mm-hmm. So it just made me more intellectually curious. You know, I really love this phrase that Nassim Taleb quotes, the farther from the shore, the deeper the ocean. You know, as you go out and explore and expand your vista, you realize how much more there is to see and find and how deep a lot of these things are. So it's great. I love it.
And I can say, you know, personally, my experience with Econ Talk has taken me far from the shoreline of my own education and experience out into that deeper ocean. And so then if you had to summarize the impact that Econ Talk has had and what you hope its legacy will be, how would you describe it?
It's kind of grand legacy. Although it's a weird thing in today's world, in theory, Econ Talk's going to be around for a long time. in some form long after I'm gone. I've tried to make the shows timeless. They're usually not about what's in the news. I've done a few recently on the pandemic and on the issue of race in America. And I expect to do a few more on that. But in general, they're a lot of them about economic fundamentals, or they're about research that is, I think, important that people will want to be thinking about and talking about for a while. Or they're about questions that are just think are generally interesting. So it's imaginable that people might still listen to it sometime in the future. And Liberty Fund, the foundation that sponsors it, has kindly and generously kept all the episodes up from the past. All 750 plus are still available. Has the negative, by the way, of exposing listeners to my early days when I wasn't as good an interviewer, but that's okay. I hope they have faith and stick with me. Maybe we'll put an addendum in front of the old episodes. This program's better in the future, so don't give up. But in terms of legacy, you know, take the question a little more, less practically and more seriously. Part of what I'm trying to do on Econ Talk is to encourage civility. And if that has any impact on people's lives, that's really wonderful. That appears to be, a lot of people kindly tell me that they argue differently than they used to. And that would be one of the best things I could accomplish if it's true. So some economic education, a little bit, make you a little bit wiser, I hope, but also maybe a little bit kinder. That would be really a great thing. But who knows? You know, who knows if anybody will be listening to podcasts in 2 years? Maybe they'll all be replaced by something else. So I don't know. We'll find out, I hope.
Our guest today has been Russ Roberts. Russ, thanks for being part of The Craft.
My pleasure, Daniel. Great job.
Thank you for listening to The Craft Podcast. For more links and information about this episode, or to listen to more episodes, you can search for The Craft by Dan Tedesco, TEDESCO, anywhere you get your podcast. See you next time, and until then, keep crafting.